Looking for tickets to your next game, concert, or show? Make shopping for tickets a little easier with TickPick, the original no-fee ticket marketplace that brings you the best prices for all of the events that you love. And now TickPick is partnering with Zip so you can shop now and pay later. Zip allows you to shop at TickPick and split your payments into easy installments. Visit TickPick.com and use the promo code ZIP20 for $20 off your first purchase of $199 or more with Zip. Now, Zip can only be used for U.S. purchases, and Zip may charge a fee at checkout. Certain merchant, product, goods, and service restrictions apply. See Zip's terms of service at www.zip.co-us. Loans through the Zip app are originated by WebBank, except for Zip-originated loans in Colorado, Nevada, Massachusetts, and Maryland. I know whenever I'm making plans, the last thing that I want to worry about is where to find my tickets. So make sure that you use TickPick.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome to another Baseball America Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined, as always, on these draft podcasts by Peter Flaherty. What's going on, Peter? How you doing, man?
Not much. Everything's going well. I can't say I've been as productive as you today on the personal fitness front, but I'm excited to break down another division.
Yeah, I'm glad we actually were just talking briefly about this before we hopped on, but I'm glad to have another gym guy at the office. I know Jeff, I don't know if he's like currently on his workout grind, but he previously was on the workout grind, and it sounds like you're a big gym guy too. So, you know, it's nice to get in there, break up the day, get a little energy, feel like you're getting strong. That's fun.
Jeff's a big hiking guy. He got at least from in our recent conversations, he's a big long walk through the woods, clear the head type of guy, which I respect.
I have not done a lot of the solo clear the head hiking. Mostly when I do hiking, it's with like the wife or some buddies for like doing some sort of mountain weekend. But I really do like hiking. It's nice being out in nature. It's a good workout. How was the hiking up there in Massachusetts? I feel like I'm very spoiled living in basically North Carolina and Virginia. There's lots of really good hiking, even if you're not right up there on the mountains.
So I'm kind of with you. I'm not a huge... I'm like the furthest thing from like an outdoorsman type of guy, like anti Bear Grylls, but it's scenic. There are some nice mountains and manageable family type of hike. So, my hypothetical kids one day, and hopefully my girlfriend will eventually become my wife, and maybe we'll, maybe that's when I'll break in the hiking shoes a little, but, yeah. Right now I'm with you just kind of, grinding it out in the gym.
Absolutely. That's awesome, man. Well, also, I'm not sure if you're a fantasy football guy, but we do have the football season cranking up both on college and NFL. Does that appeal to you at all? I feel like the longer I've been at BA, the less and less I've cared about just other sports in general. And as a UNC alum, I've pretty much entirely given up on college football, but they did win their first week. But where are you at on football in general? And are you a fantasy football player?
So it's funny. One huge fantasy football guy, NFL. I like one of my buddies with whom I went to high school. He just made the Seahawks 53-man roster. So like I'll be
That's
pulling.
Incredible.
Shout out to Jake Bobo, the pride of Belmont Hill, but I guess I'll be pulling for the Seahawks, but I'm a huge fantasy guy. I've had the same 8-team league with my closest friends from college for a while now.
So an 8-teamer. Wow. I'm in an 8-team league and I'm always terrible in that league. I feel like my roster, I look at it and every year I'm like, man, my team is stacked, but I guess that's the case for every team in the 8-team league. And I'm only in two dynasty leagues at this point. And so I never do a full redraft. So that's kind of interesting to have been in a few of those for going on like 4 and maybe 6 or 7 years for those two leagues. And one of mine, I'm coming out of a rebuild. So hopefully we can be competitive this year. But I'm also assuming, Peter, you're probably a Patriots fan, right?
No, so I'm not a Pats fan.
Let's go. That's awesome. Like,
no, it's ironic. I actually grew up like really dislike, and I still do. I really dislike the Patriots. Like I don't, I root against them every week.
I knew I liked you.
No matter who they play. So this might be news to Jeff if he listens, but no,
sorry, Jeff.
I'm not a Pats guy at all. I'm with you on the 8-team leagues because every team kind of comes out stacked in their own way, and then it could go any which way. And then on the college side, I'm an unfortunate BC football fan. I'm still clinging on to the to the 2007 season when I was 8 years old with Matt Ryan, which it was their best season in recent memory, and they still, not even recent memory at this point, and they still somehow choked it away. They started off, I think it was 9-0, and then they lost to, I'll never forget it, I was with my dad, or they were 8-0, and then they lost to a pretty mediocre Florida State team and a bad Maryland team, and they went to like this, the Sports Bowl. So
this was 2007, you said? What were you, 9 years old?
I was 8 years old. It was literally the best season of my life was 2007, which is so sad. And this year they had the easiest schedule by at least that's what the metric said in the FBS, and they lost to Northern Illinois at home. And they've got an interesting matchup this Saturday with Holy Cross. So I will be pulling for my alma mater, the Crusaders.
Nice. All right. Well, I'm sure we can probably just lament about how bad our college football teams are throughout the year, because UNC, they're not fooling me. They've tried to fool me before. We've been ranked highly before, and we always seem to crumble. So I'm not buying it, but I guess we can move forward with the football talk, or leave that behind us, I should say. We're about to wrap up an entire league here today on our draft reviews. We've got the AL West on deck, a bunch of fun draft classes here. It feels kind of weird to be about halfway done with these. These have been a blast, and I'm excited to dive into some of these today with you, Peter. We've got, so this division was actually looking pretty competitive maybe about a month ago-ish. Houston has really come on strong. The Mariners have really come on strong, I guess, since early mid-August. And it looked like we were heading for this really tight three-team race. The Rangers are trying to make that a little bit less interesting with their play, basically since September. But I think this is one of two divisions with three teams that at least have 50% or better odds to make the playoffs. The other one is the AL East. So it's a fun one, at least in terms of competition. I think the draft classes are fun as well, just given how some of these teams are spread out in terms of draft order and draft capital. But based on the standings today, as we record this on September 7th, we'll be kicking it off with the Astros. Like we've done on all the other episodes, I'll just run through our top five round picks for the Astros, and then we can kind of cut it up and talk about players we like, players who are interesting, and just overall thoughts on the class. But the Astros in the first round took Bryce Matthews, a shortstop out of Nebraska. In the second round, they took UCLA right-hander Alonzo Treadwell. In the third round, they took Georgetown right-hander Jake Bloss. In the fourth round, they took UNC Charlotte outfielder Cam Fisher. And then in the fifth round, they took Rock Canyon High School shortstop Chase Jaworski, who's out of Colorado. So that's what we're looking at for the Astros, who do have all their picks this year for the first time in what seems like a long time. Those penalties they had a few years ago really hampered them. But do you have any general thoughts on the Astros, Peter? For me, I think on draft day, they probably had, I don't think on draft day, day one, we had any really shocking picks, but I do think that Bryce Matthews was maybe the first player that I kind of raised my eyebrows a little bit just because I wasn't expecting him. But certainly in terms of draft history, that's not a crazy off the board pick for back of the first round. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Houston's one of those teams that are in a similar air, I guess, as the Rays, I guess the Mariners a little bit to an extent, the Dodgers, the Orioles, teams where, you know, they're pretty data centric, and in each pick they make, you're kind of a little more interested in to see if you can find anything under the hood. Bryce Matthews was a guy that he was a big time helium name, I think, in draft circles after the first, at least from what we were hearing, first month and a half to 2 months of the college season at Nebraska. He had a solid, I think his best, I'd say, collegiate stint up until this junior year was after his freshman year in the Northwoods. He had over 300. And then he went back to Nebraska and the Northwoods and was solid in both. The swing and miss at Nebraska was, I think, the biggest issue in the approach, which he refined some this year, finished the year hitting 360 with 11 doubles and 20 home runs. Walked almost as much as he struck out, still chased a little bit. But he's a data darling, super, super athletic, super quick hands. Exit velocity numbers were really, really loud, and he's a plus runner. So a big time upside pick. I think that coming into the draft, I viewed him more as like a a guy who was going to go in the middle slash late part of day one. And I'm with you that in watching the draft unfold, that Matthews was the first pick that I was kind of like, oh, okay, you know, this is somewhat surprising. So the Matthews at 28.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a statement of this year's draft that that pick happened at 28. Really, there wasn't anything too surprising prior to that, which is a bit uncommon.
Right. No, exactly. And I really like the two college arms taken after. Honestly, Jake Bloss might be my favorite that got taken. Georgetown right-hander. I'd say the two-plus breaking balls he was excellent in the Coastal Plain League last summer, where he was up to 98, was up to 97 this year with the fastball, which had a 30% miss rate, which was excellent. Slider, the curveball, I'd say shape wise and depth wise is the better of the two breaking balls. But the slider got more misses. It's a little bit shorter, and it has plus potential. So he's got, I'd say, three plus pitch potential down the road. And I kind of had him as a top 5 to 7 round guy in the middle of April. And, he exceeded that by a very, very wide margin. I think he's got solid 3 starter type upside. He moves well, pretty physical lower half, ease in the delivery. I really like this pick a lot. Then with Treadwell, you know, you get the 6'8".
Well, I like him a lot.
Yeah. You get the 6'8" towering right-handed pitcher. Invisible fastball up to 96, good breaking ball. He's a strike thrower. I'd say that the one little, I don't want to call it an issue because so many guys now have dealt with injuries. I think the one issue for Treadwell has been staying healthy, and being able to stay healthy and put together a full season as a starter, professionally, which I think he'll be able to do. And then upside wise, it's not unbelievably crazy upside, more like I'd say fourth starter type, but I mean, with the Astros, it's really good clay for them to work with. So I think that they got two really good college arms back to back in the second and third.
Absolutely. I think it could have easily been the case if Treadwell is healthy for the entire year that he went a little bit sooner than the 61st overall pick. He's a fascinating one to me because in high school, I never really got to see him pitch. Because he did have Tommy John surgery, missed his junior year in high school, didn't pitch a ton as a senior. I'm not sure he pitched at all as a senior. So he has a pretty lengthy track record of injuries going back to high school. He dealt with elbow and back injuries as well. I guess I already mentioned the Tommy John, so that's the elbow injury. But he was one of the better strike throwers in the class. To your point about the invisible fastball, it seems like it's not a pitch that has massive velocity. It's low 90s, touches 95. But even with those long levers, it's great carry. I think the fact that he releases the ball so far off the rubber, close to the plate, the extension that he gets helps the pitch play up. And just the touch and feel and the body control, well-rounded pitch mix, it's multiple breaking balls, really solid 12-6 curveball. Again, a solid changeup as well. And we put 60 control on him. So that's a lot of stuff to really like. And to your point, I don't think it's the most massive upside, but if he gets into pro ball and starts throwing harder and all the traits that he previously or that he already has just start playing up even more, I think it's really exciting. So I'm really hoping that he stays healthy moving forward because he's certainly a really advanced pitcher.
Yeah, without a doubt. And then I think on the college bat side, another one who kind of had a similarly explosive year as Bryce Matthews was Cam Fisher, outfielder from Charlotte. Super, super physical, 6'2", 210. He's more physical than his height weight listing shows. He's got massive forearms, big time strength in his upper body. Hit 30 home runs this year at Charlotte, hit 348, more walks and strikeouts. And so far the early returns in pro ball in affiliated baseball have been really encouraging. He's played 28 games between the complex and Fayetteville. He played one game at the complex. So focusing in on Fayetteville, he's hitting 274, 6 doubles, 3 home runs, but also a pair of triples, swipe 4 bases. The approach has been really good, chasing a little bit with spin, but, I mean, he's hammering heaters as he's done. It's plus raw power easily, borderline double plus to the pull side. He's going to be able to stick in a corner outfield spot. I think that that's a pick that they can be really, really happy about, at least early on.
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, one of the picks that I was intrigued with was Jaren Williams, a shortstop out of Toledo. They got in the ninth round, signed him for $147,000.
You stole my middle round guy. I like.
Oh, well, steals are his thing. So I guess it's fitting that I stole him from you, because he did lead Division I with 49 stolen bases. It's double plus speed. He was a consistent table setter for Toledo for a few years. This past spring, he hit over 400. Career high 14 home runs. It doesn't sound like home runs are going to be a huge factor in his game with Wood at the next level, but the fact that he was named all defensive team at shortstop, he has that speed, he has that sort of performance. He's an intriguing pick. I'm kind of curious what you think about him as a hitter, what sort of impact you think he's going to have, if he can add any value before he gets on the bases, essentially, like how much damage, what kind of hit tool. But just the tool set, the speed, the production, he was a fun one. And to see him there in the ninth, it seems like solid value for the tools that you're getting with him for that up the middle premium position guy. It sounds like he can stick there.
Yeah, I mean, he defends well at shortstop. They've used him, I'd say, more at second professionally, at least from what I saw in digging a little bit on him last night and the day before. But the speed is obviously really, really exciting with Williams. I'd say above average bat to ball skills, but I'm with you. The impact, I think, is going to be a little iffy at the next level. It's going to be a guy who, I mean, on balls down the line and in the gaps, he'll be able to take an extra base. He'll stretch what would be a single for most guys into a double into a triple and so on. I think it's probably five to 10-ish home run upside. 10 is probably even aggressive. I'd say like 5 to 7. Home run upside, but he's already shown off his double plus speed. He's 7 for 7 in stolen base attempts at Fayetteville. And he had one of the better seasons, I'd say, of anyone in Division I baseball this year. He had over 400 for Toledo, as you mentioned, 34 extra base hits, stole 49 bases. Really, really fun player, plays the game really fast. Again, the impact, I think, is the biggest question mark with him. But I think that I don't want to – the Enrique Bradfield comp is such a dangerous one because it's 80 grade and game breaking. It's almost like a speed grade in and of itself. But I think that Williams is one of those unique players that speed alone can be his carrying tool. He can run his way, I'd say, up through the ranks professionally if he can just hit enough. The approach has been good so far in pro ball, but he's gonna have to really, really hit. Impact aside, he's just gonna need to hit. So he's another fun one. And then looking further down the Astros board, Jackson Neza from Louisiana is a really, I'd say, interesting one to me. He burst onto the scene a while ago as a true freshman pitching in the NECBL. He had a 1.8 ERA with 49 Ks to 3 walks in 30 innings. And then everything took a little bit of a step back. He's always been a strikeout guy. I think that it's someone in the Astros system that they can be really excited working with because he's got good stuff. He has a track record of starting. And I think that in the late rounds, I think that they got him for 150. I think getting him just in your system is an intriguing one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one name that I wanted to mention at the end, and this is more kind of just a funky draft outcome this year, but their 20th rounder, shortstop Pascanel Ferreras, he was the last player drafted this year, and I thought that was phenomenal because he also wound up being the 500th player on the BA 500. So just the random pairing of being Mr. Irrelevant on both our draft list and in the draft itself was incredible. I don't even know what the odds of that would be, but I'm pretty confident that's never going to happen again. So I'm kind of soaking that one up. But he's kind of an interesting player in his own right. He's smaller. He's been a consistent producer for Western Carolina, a shortstop now, not a great runner. It sounds like he's probably not going to stick at that position in the long term. And he doesn't have a great track record with Wood, but he was kind of one of these players who I had talked to some scouts who were intrigued with him as a day three guy, but are a little skeptical about the amount of impact that he's going to make. So I think it's probably an uphill battle for him to get to big league value. But I essentially just wanted to talk about the fact that he was BA 500, number 500, and the last player in the draft, number 614 this year. So that was fun.
I was going to say, I remember on day three of the draft, I remember you pointing that out and being rightfully so super fired up about it. I thought it was super, super cool as well. It was a much needed
adrenaline spike for me at that point. Got the
I was going to say at that point, you're probably running on fumes. So similar endorphin rush to a workout, but with Pastner, like you mentioned, I mean, he's been the face of the Western Carolina program for the last 3 years. Nearly 340 hitter in college. With medal showed well, as you mentioned, there's really no wood bat track record. I mean, he was a two-time Whitey Red Sox on the Cape, but really little performance. The approach is that both the approach and bat to ball skills are below average. Impact also below average, and I don't think he'll stick at shortstop. But again, as you mentioned, it's more just fun that that he was their last selection and the last selection of the draft, as well as the last guy on the BA board.
Yeah, last thing I have to say about the Astros draft is this was the first draft under new GM Dana Brown. He obviously has a pretty strong track record based on his time with the Braves, a lot of successful drafts there. I was interested to see if there was any significant shift in philosophy, but it does seem like Dana's general philosophy of just being more data-driven. I remember when he came and started kind of running the show in the scouting department there, there was a lot of talk about how the Braves were going from more of this old school scouting approach to more of a hybrid, where data would be valued a lot more. It seems like, to your point earlier, that's kind of what the Astros are known for. It seems like maybe that's what this draft is as well. Another fun note with this draft is 25% of the players they selected came out of California, which is a pretty significant portion of players. It's not shocking that it's one of the big three talent producing states. California, Texas, and Florida would be those three, but it's kind of interesting that they went so heavy with California guys, although just one of those California players was taken within the top six rounds. So those are kind of my thoughts on the Astros. Any final comments, Peter?
No, that was interesting about the West Coast flavor. Actually, I didn't pick up on that in my initial dive into the class, but I mean, especially at the prep level, at least what I've seen, all these West Coast kids are super, super polished. They kind of play the game, and they have their own brand of baseball. They like 100%. To play baseball sometimes. I really like how they play. So,
I'm surprised that you like it. I'm not a massive fan of it, but it's probably also because there have been some players who I think should be turning on the ball more consistently and hitting for more impact. Garrett Mitchell, maybe number one on this list. And I hated seeing him kind of slap the ball the other way and just run out of the box. But what also is interesting is a lot of the players that took out of California were college California players. And when I think of California, it seems like a lot of the talent that comes out is like the high school players. And more it seems like the high school players in California are being recruited out of state to go towards power schools in the SEC and the ACC. So it was interesting to see the number of college California players specifically.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like the West Coast feel.
Okay, cool. Well, we don't have to agree on everything. I don't hate it. I just am not a bunting fan. I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast, me and you, but just bunting kind of.
I feel they do play very small. They're splash and dash move. I mean, they're the type to like bunt at area code. So
exactly. See, I hate that. Bunting at area codes just drives me crazy. But, you know, some players, I think it's a real tool for them. So I can't entirely hate on it, but I'll hate on it just a little bit. All right, our next team we have here is the Seattle Mariners, maybe one of the most fascinating teams in the draft overall, just given the number of picks they had. They picked at number 22 with their normal first-round pick. They had a PPI pick at number 29 for Julio Rodriguez getting a Rookie of the Year, and they also had the first supplemental first-round pick at number 30. So three picks in the top 30, significantly more pool money to throw around than their counterparts picking in the final third of the draft. We can talk through how they use that money. But to run through their picks in the top five rounds, they took Colt Emerson, shortstop out of Ohio, at 22. They took Virginia high school outfielder Johnny Farmello at number 29. They took Georgia shortstop Ty Peete at number 30. In the second round, they took William and Mary third baseman Ben Williamson. In the third round, they took Wake Forest right-hander Teddy McGraw. In the fourth round, they took Texas high school outfielder Aiden Smith. And in the fifth round, they took Wichita State shortstop Brock Rodden. So a ton of players to talk through here. I guess more than anything, I'm curious, what would your strategy be, Peter, if you were kind of heading up a scouting department and you had all of these picks and you had all this draft capital? Would you play it straight up? Would you try and cut a deal early and just take even more advantage of your money by spreading around throughout the draft? Would you do the opposite and spend early, try and float someone down the board to you? Do you think there's one ideal strategy that you would like, or do you think it kind of just depends on the board that's available to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would depend year to year who's in the class and who might be available in that slot. But I do like what Seattle did here with getting three pretty prominent high school hitters early on and getting a little aggressive and making sure to sign them. I like that approach. I'm kind of in the, at least especially in this range, less so worry about, to an extent, who I would have in my hypothetical system. Mm-hmm. Just go out and get the best players available and just stack it.
I think that's smart.
And let the chips fall how they will.
The one thing that I feel like we should note here is Seattle did spend the smallest percentage of their bonus pool this year, which I feel like is kind of leaving a lot on the table considering the bonus pool they had and where they were picking. They spent just 97.7% of their bonus pool. They had just over 13 million to spend. They spent 12.8 million. So that puts them at the bottom of the table in terms of just overage that you're using. They left quite a bit of money on the table without suffering any real penalties. Although I think in the Mariners case, when you're taking so many high school players early, if you wind up signing those players to less than you expected, maybe that makes sense. Just you might need to play it a little bit more safe when you're doing your calculations throughout the draft, just knowing that these high school players have a little bit more leverage. So I don't say this to like bury the Mariners by any means. I just think it's interesting to think through the challenges of kind of making sure you get all your players signed when you do go so high school heavy very early on in the draft, because you really don't want to miss on one of those picks. And to the Mariners' credit, they signed every player in their class except for 20th rounder William Watson.
Yeah, no, and I'm a huge fan of the trio of high schoolers they took early, particularly Colt Emerson. I've been kind of following Emerson rather heavily, I'd say, since the summer of 2021. He was on the Yankees underclass area code team, and it was him and Kevin McGonigal. The middle infield was Emerson at short, McGonigal at second. They'd switch off game to game up there, up the middle.
What an absolute terror for opposing pitchers to have to pitch to both those guys in the same lineup.
And then at third, it was Andre Madunio. It was a fun infield, but no, I really love Emerson. The hit tool is obviously the calling card with him. He's a super polished hitter, sound approach, pretty compact swing. The barrel feel, I think, is off the charts. I like the hand action, and I mean, he's demonstrated the ability to just spray line drives all across the field. And I think that what's also appealing with Emerson is, I mean, I think that he's just barely 18. I think he turned 18 a week after the draft. And so, I mean, there's going to be room just naturally as he progresses in age. He'll get more physical and add some more impact there. So I think that while the hit tool is the carrying one, there's going to be power that starts to come rather naturally. They're not going to have to do much for at least to get a little bit more power. And then I think defensively, he might end up at second. I think that the actions and arm strength and athleticism, everything combined, I think that's where he might be best in the future. But again, I think the bat is going to be enough where he hits his way to the majors.
Yeah, he's probably been the most impressive high school player in this class in their pro debut so far. He's played in rookie ball for 8 games, low A for 12 games. Overall, he's hitting 365, 495, 541 with a pair of homers, 7 doubles, 7 stolen bases, hasn't been caught yet, and 14 walks to 16 strikeouts. I think, like you had said, what immediately jumped out to me for Emerson was just the really advanced approach, his ability to make strong swing decisions consistently, his timing against all pitch types. It's a really consistent, easy, balanced swing with not a lot of unnecessary movements at all. I was always really impressed by that. And like you said, he is very young. He has some projection to the body, and I think he's got a chance for solid tools across the board. And I'm curious to see how those tick up in the future if he does add some strength. Again, I think he has fine actions at shortstop. We did hear that, maybe he slides to third base, maybe he slides to second in the future. But I'm curious to see how long he is able to stick there. Because if he adds some strength, the arm strength improves, he gets a little bit quicker, it wouldn't be shocking for me, even if it maybe is more likely for him to move off. But I love high school shortstops, and Colt Emerson pretty much does everything on the field really well. And that combined with his very strong pro debut should have Mariners fans pretty thrilled.
No, without a doubt. And the early returns, I think, I mean, Emerson, they've been excellent. I mean, as you cited the numbers, same with Farmello, who I really like, 6'2", 200 lean, I'd say plus hit tool. A guy that the power I think is going to come, as he adds some physicality, double plus runner. I think he's got an above average arm in the outfield where he's a good defender. I like that pick. And then with Ty Pete, he's a super, super exciting player. 6'3", tons of room to add some weight, double plus bat speed. And I think that this spring was the first time that he really got into his power, in game. And prior to this spring where he was exclusively a shortstop, he was also used on the mound a little bit, where I think he was up to 94, 95. So he got a plus arm, super, super athletic. I mean, there's a chance that, I don't know if this is where he ends up, but I mean, he could end up in center field down the road. That's how athletic and twitchy he is, the arm strength. It's a ceiling play. I mean, the ceiling with Ty Pete is, I mean, it's as high as a lot of these high school guys in the draft. With the upside that he possesses, there's a little bit of a low floor. I think that so far, again, he's hitting, I'd say, reasonably well for a high schooler in affiliated baseball. Three doubles, two home runs, striking out a little bit. I think that the biggest issue for Pete so far has been a little bit of a jumpy, overly aggressive approach. The bat to ball skills have actually been, I'd say, pretty good. He's running a 90% in zone contact rate in Modesto so far. But he's chasing a lot and swinging and missing a lot. He's not really missing fastballs all that much, but the chase rate is 49%. And then he's struggling a little bit with spin, both seeing it and also chasing it. But that's to be expected. He's a newly 18-year-old, even newer than Emerson, facing professional pitchers. So there's obviously going to be an adjustment period. But I'd say so far he's shown the flashes of, you know, why Seattle took him so early. And he's a very, very exciting player.
Yeah, Ty Pete, I think, will be extremely fascinating. Throughout the draft or the spring season, I feel like he was one of the more polarizing players. There are a few teams that seem to like him more around that third round range. I talked to a few scouts who, entering the spring, preferred him as a prospect on the mound. And when he wasn't pitching, they were significantly less interested. And then there always seemed to be just a handful of teams that are really high on him as a hitter, like the upside potential that you've just broken down really well. And clearly the Mariners were one of those teams. So I'll be really curious to see how the hit tool develops, where he settles in defensively, because there's no doubt he's a really impressive athlete. And I think even Johnny Farmello too, the more I learned about him athletically, he really graded out well at a number of tests and athletic assessments at the combine. He's a consistent double plus runner. I got to see him quite a bit, just kind of being in my backyard here in Northern Virginia this spring. I like the bat quite a bit. I think he's going to be a good defender in center field. And to your point, I think he showed some solidish raw power to where I don't think he's going to be a guy that gets the bat kind of knocked out of his hands. So really fun, up the middle, athletic trio of high school players to kick off a draft that has a lot to like here. So moving down the board further, Peter, are there any players that jump out to you that you're intrigued with either on day two or day three?
Yeah, I was going to say I really like the high schoolers they took. And then I also like the pair of college guys that they took immediately after in the second and third rounds, respectively, with Ben Williamson was another on day one where,
maybe the most surprising. Matthews,
I was really surprised to, I mean, he's a great player, a solid college track record, but I was very surprised to hear him.
I think it makes, I was surprised when I initially heard it. I think given their kind of draft strategy, it makes sense getting a college senior who presumably at that time you're thinking you can lock in some savings, but still get maybe a priority senior sign type. He signed for $1.4 million, the slot value was $1.4 million. He signed for $600,000. So that gave them about $836,000 in savings towards the pool, which I imagine after you take those first three high school players, you feel pretty confident in. And then they also had an overslot player in the fourth round as well. So definitely was a strategic pick, but I think one of the advantages of having all these picks is not only can you get the best college seniors to save money, you can just lock that in early and feel comfortable that you have some of it to work with, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, as you mentioned, he was, I think, the best, for my money's worth, the best senior sign in this year's draft. And he was outstanding at William & Mary, had a really good, albeit brief, Cape stint for Hyannis, where they actually moved him around the diamond a little bit. He played center, left. They used him at shortstop a little bit. Name of the game with Williamson is a really polished approach and plus bat-to-ball skills. He's hit a little bit of a rut in Modesto. He's injured right now, striking out a little bit more than I think people would have anticipated. But again, the hit tool combined with his approach and bat-to-ball skills, that's going to be the name of the game for Williamson going forward. There's not a ton of power there. He's going to have to hit his way to the bigs, I think. And then with Teddy McGraw in the third, coming into this season, at least there was significant day one buzz, I think, surrounding him. But unfortunately he missed the entire college season rehabbing from Tommy John. It's his second time getting the surgery, which is a little bit of a red flag. There's obviously some risk involved with that pick, but I think the fact that you can sign someone for $600,000 with that type of upside, I mean, he was allegedly up to 100, 101 in the fall with his fastball, with I'd say a plus high spin slider, low release height. I think signing him and even if you reach a little bit for him, maybe in the third round, you might end up in a few years looking like an absolute genius for getting McGraw, mm-hmm. for taking the risk and taking that leap, because he's got as electric stuff as a lot of these college arms in the draft.
Yeah, I'm with you entirely. Again, we talked about this on a previous podcast about just a couple of these college pitchers who were taken early on day two, who were injured, didn't pitch, represent a decent amount of risk. But just given the supply of college pitching in that range of the draft, I'm kind of a fan of going high upside and taking some of these guys who, if healthy, could have, to your point, easily been day one targets. If he was healthy, I think he certainly would have been a pitcher who goes off the board on the first day. And I think the Mariners have also developed a pretty solid reputation recently of developing arms well. I think the hitters are coming along as well for them. They seem to be, at this point, just a really well-run organization, solid farm system. They've added a lot of talent to it. So I have some confidence in them getting the most out of McGraw moving forward. Again, I think health is obviously your biggest question, but he is a guy who maybe could have shown some improvement in control as well. Not sure how much just the injury history that he's dealt with has led to those control concerns, but the stuff is pretty loud.
No, big time. And I think in that same breath, when you talk about Seattle and developing arms, there was one guy in the middle of day two that I was really excited to see them take. And that was Winthrop right-hander Brody Hopkins. College numbers aren't really anything to write home about if you just look at the back of the baseball card. But it is electric stuff from the right side. Fastball up to 98, supplemented by a plus slider. He's unbelievably athletic, 6'4", 200 pounds. I think he was a 6'4", 60 type of guy, maybe even down in the 6'3 range from what I heard. He could athletic enough where in college when he was playing both ways, that he played center field. So I think for an organization like Seattle that has shown, I think they're developing their prowess in developing arms, He has a chance to be a really, really fun reliever down the road if you can just get the command and control refined a little bit. But two plus pitches right now, I think that his long-term future is in the bullpen, but I think that he could end up being one of the more effective relievers down the road. And that's a guy you can get a little bit aggressive with and moving him through the system.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned him, because he was one of the more interesting players to talk to scouts about throughout the spring, because you look at the numbers, and like you said, he wasn't a great performer really as a pitcher or a hitter, but every time I talked to scouts, they really were in love with this guy's stuff, his athleticism, just the overall talent. And I think everyone that I had spoken with was really excited about the idea of getting him into a pro development system and trying to kind of refine some of the stuff that he has really on both sides. I talked to scouts who liked him as a hitter as well, but I think more probably liked him as a pitcher. So he'll be really exciting to see. And again, one of those guys where if you're just looking at the numbers, you're probably missing a huge picture of who he is.
Yeah, no, without a doubt.
All right. How about day three? We've got, unsurprisingly, a large number of college players who went on day three after going early with high school players. Any names jump out to you? One of the most interesting picks for me on day three was William Watson, just given what he did at the junior college level, fast arm and fastball up to mid-90s, solid curveball as well. But he is the only player in this class who didn't get signed, so maybe we shouldn't spend too much time on him. But maybe he could be an interesting I'm trying to think now. I don't know if he has another year at JC. I'll need to check this one out if he would be eligible for the draft and follow rules, or if that's just high school players going to JC. Now I'm kind of blanking on that one.
I'm almost positive he is, he is eligible for that draft and follow, but.
So that makes this one more intriguing. I'll check real quick while you talk about your day threes, if you have any.
Yeah, I like Carson Jones from Virginia Tech. They got him in the 15th. And I mean, with Jones, it's big time raw power, has I'd say track record with Wood where he showed that raw power. I know if you look at his baseball reference page or whatnot, you only see one home run in 2022, but he hit a handful of home runs in the playoffs for Bourne, was a home run derby participant. It's no doubt plus raw power. To all fields, I think it really well at Virginia Tech this year. So far, early, not super, super loud at the complex. But again, there for everybody, whether you're a high school guy or a college player, there is going to be an adjustment period. But big time, I'd say raw power upside getting him in the 15th round. There's really low risk involved. Jacob Sharp is another. Getting a little bit deeper into day three in the 17th. Smaller, I'd say, build and frame for a catcher, not super, super physical, but hit really well at UNLV, hit .330 with 13 doubles and 12 home runs. Really quick and kind of buggy whip hands that I was kind of impressed with in watching him play. I'd say it's maybe a tick above average of a throwing arm, behind the plate. And then again, has only played 11 games in the complex. So those are a couple of deeper guys, not as super exciting a day three as maybe some of these other teams. I really like what they did at the top in the top five rounds or so. But a couple of college players who are relatively, I'd say, low risk picks.
Yeah, and I just checked. William Watson was a sophomore this past year at San Joaquin Delta College, so I'm not entirely sure if he does qualify, if he's going to a four-year college, but I also couldn't find out what four-year he's going to. So I'll have to circle
back. He's going to USC.
Okay, perfect. Then I don't think he qualifies for this in that case. All right, let's move on to Texas. Texas has, in many ways, the exact opposite sort of draft strategy, draft capital that the Mariners did. Mariners were picking late in the first round with a bunch of draft capital relative to their picking point. The Rangers were picking in the top five, kind of the elite tier of this year's class, and then also didn't have a second or third round pick. So they had significantly less money. than all of the teams picking around them. I was curious to see how they would handle that. And I really love the strategy they went with. We'll just roll through their picks really quickly. We don't have as many to talk through here. Wyatt Langford was their first overall pick, their first round pick at number four overall, an outfielder out of Florida. They took Santa Clara right-handed pitcher Skylar Hales in the fourth round, all the way at pick 108 as their second selection in the draft. And then they took Miami right-handed pitcher Alejandro Rosario in the fifth round. So obviously this draft class is going to really revolve around Langford and revolve around one player more than I think probably any other draft class this year, because in addition to just that $9.9 million bonus pool they had, despite picking top five, they also went over slot for Langford. And I feel like a number of other teams in their position would have done the exact opposite to try and just maximize the money they had to work with. I mean, Texas, even just a year prior, did something similar when they took Kamar Rocker, didn't pick for a few rounds, and then overslotted Brock Porter. So they did go with a different strategy. And I think just based on where they're picking and with the talent available, I quite like this pick for them, because I do think that even still, Dylan Cruz gets most of the hype, and I think rightfully so. But Wyatt Langford is extremely close to him in terms of prospect status, in terms of impact ability, in terms of tools, college production. And I think he was the third best player in this class, and they got him at number four. So just overall thoughts on this strategy, Langford in general, or we can move down the board if you want as well, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I was a huge fan of obviously Langford in college, as was everyone else, but I think you hit on a key point where I think entering the draft that the gap between Cruz and Langford was way, way slimmer than people may have realized. And Langford is right there, at least with me, in terms of favorite college hitter, right there with Dylan Cruz. I really don't think he's that far off at all.
And he's been tremendous in his pro debut, both the batted ball data, the underlying metrics, his actual performance. He's already been pushed to double A, between rookie ball, high A, double A, with most of these games coming with high A Hickory. He's hitting 340, 445, 660, six home runs, 12 doubles, 20 walks, 22 strikeouts. So just the pure hitting ability he's shown, on top of the massive power and just torque he gets in his swing, and the approach, the ability to take a walk, spit on bad pitches, swing at good ones. Like, he is a complete package offensively, and is part of the reason why this class was so good, because you almost have two just elite, toolsy, productive college outfielders. Really, the only question with Langford is he going to be an up-the-middle player? He's only played a couple games in center field. I think he's probably going to be a corner outfielder, but I think he's going to give you more than enough hitting ability and power to profile just fine there. And I think really on any list that we have with Cruz and Langford on it, the gap between them is always going to look bigger than I think the actual talent gap between them.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you touched on who he was as a player really well, but I mean, super physical. It's double plus bat speed, I think, plus raw power to all fields. You mentioned the chance for him to even play some center field as he goes through professional baseball. I know that he played a couple of games there, I think, in Hickory, and so far it's just been exclusively left field for Frisco. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, he'll be, I think, used in center field as he continues to progress. And, I mean, the early returns have been outstanding for Langford. He hit really well in Hickory and is already up in double A and has looked pretty good in his first couple of games. I think what makes him so special is, and you mentioned it, is the approach and the ability to kind of take a free base and not and be comfortable settling for a walk sometimes. So in other years, this is a player that usually goes number one overall. And I think that the fact that he fell into the Rangers lap at fourth overall is unbelievable for them, especially in a draft where they didn't pick again, as you mentioned, until the fourth round. I think that with what Langford is going to do production wise and the type of impact that I think he'll have at the major league level, I think having this draft basically just be focused all around him.
I'm excited to see too how quickly he gets pushed, because we've seen some teams be really aggressive, but the Rangers again, both the Rangers and the Twins picking in the top five are, I feel like, are the teams that are most ready to win now. The Rangers are obviously in a playoff race that invested heavily in the big league team. Like, I want to see him pushed as quickly as he's able to be pushed. I think he's ready both from a skill perspective and from a physicality perspective, more than ready from a physicality perspective. I do think if he gets to the big leagues, his right-handed swing will be one of the most fun to watch in baseball. Just when he turns on a ball and connects, it's so powerful and strong. It's just a joy to watch. Some of the home runs that he hit in the College World Series were just kind of mind-boggling. And I'm also curious, too, to see what the run tool settles into. Because one of the reasons why he was so exciting last fall with Florida is out of nowhere, seemingly, he was turning in double plus run times. And he's not consistently a double plus runner. We put 60 grade on his future run tool. I think that speed is part of the reason why scouts are kind of intrigued about whether or not he can play center field. But I am curious to see if he's able to add value on the bases. He does have a few bags already in pro ball, 8 for 10 so far. So he's just really toolsy, really fascinating, interesting background. But really just a tremendous hitter that kind of squares his profile.
Yeah, no, big time. And then I think, I mean, with the Rangers, they only had so many picks, but I like Alejandro Rosario in the fifth round, right-hander out of Miami. He's a pitcher that I remember seeing it somewhere, but pitch usage with him, I think, hindered him and hindered his performance some. He's throwing his fastball a lot, not throwing his slider as much. In his summer stint on the Cape with Hyannis, threw his fastball, I think it was 60% of the time, threw his slider a lot more at 23% of the time, which I know you're anyone listening and they hear a lot more and it's 23% of the time. I think he only threw it 15% of the time in the spring of 2022. Mm-hmm. This year again, struggled a little bit with control and the back of the baseball card isn't going to look great, but I think that against Wood, for a pitcher like him, he'll fare really well. Mid to upper 90s fastball. I think that the slider is a plus pitch as well as the changeup being above average. So intriguing pick there in the fifth.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought him up. I'm fascinated to see what the pitch profile is going to look like in pro ball. I'm like cautiously optimistic about Rosario because of those, like some of the conversations I've had with scouts who are with you and think that he could be unlocked a little bit. If he does throw the secondaries a bit more, but also just having seen him in high school. I mean, he was throwing mid 90s, getting into the upper 90s in high school. And it always seems like for whatever reason, the fastball just got hit around more than you would expect. I mean, it's difficult for high school players to turn around mid 90s velocity. But that happened quite a bit with him. He is a shorter player. I don't think he has the best extension in the world. It certainly doesn't seem like his fastball shape is the greatest. So if you have sort of dead zone fastball shape, no deception, poor extension, like I'm curious to see if they change the fastball, if he adds a cutter, if he just tries to just go more towards a sinker, like what they do to try and just get hitters off the barrel. Because I mean, the damage that hitters did against his fastball just this spring at college was fairly significantly better than what they managed against his secondary. So he's intriguing just from like a, how are the Rangers going to be able to transform him at the next level? And then my most interesting pick on day two, I feel like the Rangers are always good for this prospect that I've never heard of. And I feel foolish afterwards for not having heard of this player. Really, ever since Evan Carter, I feel like they've been tormenting me in this regard. But Caden Scarborough is a right-handed pitcher out of Florida who just sounded really fascinating when I was circling back after the pick and trying to get some information on him. Pretty under the radar for most of the scouting industry. A lot of the scouts I talked to, they kind of knew who he was, but didn't go see him or were unfamiliar with him in general. Big frame, 6'5", 190 pounds. The fastball is ticking up in the right direction. And I think maybe the most impressive tool for him right now is like a really sharp downer curveball with good finish and spin. So he's kind of this dark horse under the radar type who clearly the Rangers liked enough to give $500,000 to, and a name that I'll be curious to see how he progresses moving forward. Just because, again, the Rangers always seem to pick a guy that I don't know about that turned out to be quite good.
I remember seeing him somewhere, I think on Twitter, a bullpen video of his kind of blew up. And I mean, that's a great call. He's super interesting, really athletic, as you mentioned. I had one on day two, one on day three, maybe jumping the gun a little bit. In the eighth round, they got catcher Julian Brock from Louisiana. Hit 315 this spring, 17 doubles and 11 home runs. Pretty physical and larger in stature than the typical catcher. He's 6'3", 215. But this summer, he was the best defensive catcher I saw. Moved really well. It's an easy plus arm. I remember distinctly threw out a couple of plus runners with throws right on the money. Flashed above average raw power. I think if you can get a catcher where I think that even for as well as he hit, I think the defense is first with him. And if he can continue to hit even a little bit professionally, that's a great pick in the eighth. And then the 13th, Will Privet from the College of Charleston. They got him for just 150. He's really, I mean, calling him a two pitch guy would almost be generous. He throws his fastball 88% of the time, but he's kind of one of one in that regard in terms of, I'd say, college pitchers. Threw 88% of the time, had a 37% miss rate on it. I mean,
reminds me of Ty Floyd last year. I feel like his fastball is close to 90% rate, and then this spring he added the slider usage a bit.
Yeah, and I mean, he could signal it on the mound, and hitters would still swing and miss at it. I mean, it just disappears about a foot or two from the plate. He throws from a super deceptive, almost slingshotty, over the top arm slot. He calls it a curveball. It doesn't have a ton of depth, but I mean, if he can just land it for strikes, it doesn't even have to be good. Just to keep hitters off balance and change their eyes a little bit, it can be an effective offering. I think that I'm not sure how often we've seen guys succeed with really one pitch professionally, especially at the big league level. So I think that he's going to have to get something else in his arsenal, especially where he's predominantly 92 to 95. It's not insane velo. And then so far at the complex, he struggled surprisingly with command and control. He was always a strike thrower and in and around the zone in college, but so far eight walks across three games, the complex, really, really early return. So
I wonder if it is one of those things where he's used to just dominating with one pitch in college, and maybe he doesn't feel as confident he can do that in pro ball. And so he feels like he needs to be even more precise with the fastball and trying to hit the edges. You miss the edges, and then the walk rate suddenly jumps up a little bit. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that repertoire develops over the next few years.
Yeah, no, big time.
All right. You hit on the guys that I was curious about on day three with Privet, and you also hit on Julian Brock, who's an interesting catcher. With Brock specifically, I'll just say, like, I'm curious to see how he handles secondaries and velocity. He didn't face a ton of great velocity this spring. So those two are pretty important if you want to be a hitter professionally. So I'll be curious to see like what the hit tool settles into. Can he catch up to good velocity? Can he handle the secondary stuff? But to your point, the defensive stuff sounds really good. He's got power. Fun draft for Texas, even though not picking a lot. I really think that for most people, this will be the draft of Wyatt Langford. Though they're going to have some fun experiments with a lot of these pitchers. So,
and there was one more on day three that I wanted to mention, and he's a 14th round pick from the College of Southern Idaho, 6'2" left-hander Josh Trentadue. 6'2", 185 was one of the better. I mean, I didn't do my due diligence with. I don't even know like what College of Southern Idaho. I think it's a JUCO. So it's a JUCO, was one of the better JUCO arms, especially one of the better JUCO left-handers this spring. 118 strikeouts and 66 innings pitched. Interesting fastball breaking ball combo, strike thrower, and so far he's been carving at the complex. So fun follow. They got him for 125, and I think that he might end up being one of the better, I think, hits that they have in this draft class, just given both the lack of picks and then the arms. There's kind of, I'd say, in my opinion, outside of Scarborough and maybe Rosario, there's not one that's, and maybe I think Hales has to be included in that, but there's not one that's really that much, I'd say, better than the others. They went, I kind of liked that the JUCO route that they went. Isaac Tiger's another one in the seventh, was up to 97, 98 this summer on the Cape. So there are a lot of like really, really fun, I'd say interesting follows. I mean, clearly the focal point was Langford, and I mean, he'll remain the focal point of this draft, but some sneaky fun guys to keep an eye on and keep tabs on as you go further down the board.
Yeah. And Josh Trinity was a good one. I think he was the only player in 2023 who was drafted and signed out of Idaho. The Red Sox did take Robert Orlowski in the 20th round, who was probably the only prominent Idaho prospect out of the high school ranks. And if he had signed, he would have been just the third player, I believe, to be drafted and signed out of Idaho in the bonus pool era. But unfortunately, he did not sign. So that's Texas. Let's move on to the Angels here. Let me pull up there. Yeah, let me pull up theirs. They'll be fun. Sorry, I've got this Idaho filter on. Okay, Los Angeles Angels. They're picking 11th overall. They did not have a second-round pick, but they notoriously took Nolan Chanuel at number 11 overall, who is already a big leaguer. Florida Atlantic first baseman. They took Stanford third baseman Alberto Rios in the third round. They took Sam Houston outfielder Joe Redfield in the fourth round. And they took Harvard right-handed pitcher Chris Clark in the fifth round. A ton of different directions we could go here with the Angels draft. It's a fascinating draft. I thought that the consistent kind of trait that tied a lot of their players together in this draft were just a lot of hitters with really strong contact ability, vision, and swing decisions. Chanuel obviously is going to be the poster boy for that for a decent amount of time, just considering what he's doing in the big leagues right now, his bat of ball data in college. But Alberto Rios and Joe Redfield also have similar traits in that regard. A few other hitters even further down the board, I think, as well. Sam Brown on day three stood out for some of those same reasons. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this draft? Because they clearly had a strategy they wanted to go with. We heard that they wanted a fast-moving college player in that first slot. I assumed at the time when we were hearing about the sort of player profile they wanted that they were going to get a college player on a deal. And the player would want that because they knew they would move quickly. The fact that they signed Chanuel at number 11 for slot surprised me then, and it even still surprises me now. We had him ranked number 30. So I think it's a massive win for Chanuel. Obviously, he got $5 million and is already a big leaguer. So what are your thoughts on this one, Peter?
Yeah, this was, I mean, quite the draft class in general. For the Angels, obviously, Chanuel is the headliner, and he's already a big leaguer. I didn't think that even with how aggressive that the Angels have been in the last couple of years, that we'd have a big leaguer. And it was by Joel. I think he got called up in August. So
Literally historic rise. I think we can't be faulted for not expecting that one, right?
Yeah, but nonetheless, I mean, it's almost like stale to talk about what he did in college at this point. but I mean, he hit like, I think when we were talking about the Golden Spikes Award and who should be considered for it.
Yeah, both Peter and I got votes for that. So just to get that out there.
But yeah, no, he hit 450 with 18 doubles, 19 home runs. But the calling card, as you mentioned, he had a 615 OBP with a 71-14 walk to strikeout ratio. Mm-hmm. The approach and bat to ball skills are, I'd say, both off the charts against fastballs, especially. He had an overall contact rate of 97%, and in zone contact rate of 98% against heaters. And then, I mean, I guess like now you got to talk about what he's doing at the big league level. And leading up to that, he hit really well in Rocket City and in the Inland Empire, in low A. The big question with Chanuel again is just going to be the impact and if he's going to be able to hit enough to still be a productive and effective big leaguer. And you know what, even with all the question marks surrounding his game and what kind of his profile might be in the future, he has held his own so far in the big leagues, which is an unbelievable feat for someone who was playing in the Conference USA less than 4 months ago. He's hitting .286 with more walks than strikeouts. He only has one double. I would really be curious to see the exit velocity numbers. I know he's got at least one over 100. But again, with him, the contact rate has been really, really high. The in zone contact rate of 89% against fastballs is impressive. An overall contact rate of 82%, which for, I think, someone that's moving as fast as him, is rather impressive. I think that defensively he's strictly first base, even though he got some run in right field both last summer and at Florida Atlantic. But not to put, you know, any added pressure on Nolan, I don't think he'll ever hear this, but I mean, he's going to have to really, really, really hit to be an effective and productive big leaguer. I think that right now he's a really fun story for most because of how fast he got called up and how aggressive the Angels are. But I think that the allure might wear off a little bit and you're going to want to see more balls and gaps and over the fence.
Yep.
And at the very least, you're going to want to see him to really, really be able to rake. So I'm very curious to see how this ends up transpiring.
Yeah. And I do wonder how much of it is just his approach to hitting at this stage. And even in general, even going back to high school, he was always a pure hitter, more than a power guy. This spring, we heard from some scouts who thought he had solid raw power in the tank. And I do think that he's probably going to have to sacrifice a little bit of contact and hit for more power to profile as a first baseman. I wonder how much of that is just him trying to slap the ball, make a lot of contact, get on base. Like, if he's able to make that switch or if it's just a case where he really doesn't have a lot of power. I would probably lean more towards the former at this stage, just seeing a few of the home runs he hit in college. But at the same time, I do think the exit velocities and the batted ball data is a bit concerning. His batted ball data is more similar to players like Enrique Bradfield and Chandler Simpson and a lot of kind of scrappy, skinny, up-the-middle players who are speed-oriented. And that just is really tough to play when you're a big league first baseman and you need to hit for impact and you need to drive the ball. I think he's probably going to wind up being one of the more polarizing players in this class for a decent amount of time because, I mean, he should get praise for posting a 430 essentially OBP in 15 games at the big league level after basically going from mid-major college straight to the big leagues. People are going to like the batting average, but there are also going to be people who are really skeptical of the power and of the impact. And it's just a really odd profile. It's a unique story. It was an aggressive pick from the Angels in my mind that you could argue that has already paid off. And maybe you could argue that that's not a pick you would want there just given the impact. I think one of the questions about this draft class for me is where is the impact? It is a lot of college contact oriented players. And I think that's why I'm maybe most interested in Barrett Kent of their top 10 round guys, a high school right-hander, their first high school player, I think they took. I'm really fascinated with him, expected him to get to Arkansas after he didn't go in the first five rounds or so, but they got him signed for basically $1 million in the eighth round. I guess we could talk about Shanuel all day, but are there any players that you like similar to me with Kent here in the eighth round or players that you think are maybe a little stepped on?
Yeah, it was a really, really interesting draft class in general for the Angels. Taking Rios in the third, again, was, I know it, a guy like that after what he did at Stanford is only going to be on the board for so long, but coming into this season, Rios had only logged 7 collegiate at bats at Stanford, ended up hitting .384 with 24 doubles and 18 home runs, won Pac-12 player of the year, had as good a season as you can get, as you can have. So far he's hitting for, I'd say, a decent amount of power. But he, that is also coming with, some swing and miss. And then I also like, Chris Clark in the fifth, out of Harvard. He's thrown the ball well so far in Inland Empire. Nice fastball slider combination with, I'd say, a changeup that's coming along. I think developing that is going to be a key for him, especially if they're going to want to, keep starting him. But, I like Clark in the fifth. Manasi in the sixth is obviously, I'd say, a household
name.
Yeah, I'd say he's a household name at this point after what he did at Wake Forest. One of the better college relievers, which is a round range that I think makes sense for.
I didn't think maybe that one's pretty good value. I expected him to be top 5 rounds, I think, maybe.
Yeah, I think getting him down the board there was, that's a win for them. He's getting hit around a little bit so far, but this is also coming off of a season in which he appeared 30 times for Wake. So I think getting an off season and getting some rest will be helpful for him. And then I think just as I keep talking down this draft board, Zach Joyce in the 14th is fun because, you know, Ben is his brother. He's made it up to the big league club with the Angels, currently rehabbing. Doesn't have the 105 mile per hour velocity as his brother does, but
what a bum.
Yeah, I know he's only 96-99 with an above average slider, really similar delivery to his brother. Again, they got him for really cheap. And then, as you mentioned, it's just kind of a bunch of, I'd say, older college guys. And then just with the Angels and how they're operating nowadays, Mac McCrossy, their 20th round pick, is in double A right now. So he's played 33 games. He played 3 games at the complex. And then they promoted him to double A, which, yeah. You know, he's 23. I get it that you got to be, you know, guys of that age, their windows might be closing a little bit quicker than others, but they are super, super aggressive with their guys. But I guess McCrossy is holding his own to an extent.
There's very clearly a direction at the Angels where they need or want to take fast moving players are going to be at the big leagues quickly. The last 3 years, they've really employed this strategy. Everything about the players they selected this year makes you think that's continued. I mean, we straight up heard it before the draft that that's who they were targeting in the first round, specifically someone who could move quickly. So that's clearly their MO in the draft, given their team this year. And I guess some of the players they're really trying to win with before they're either their peaks are beyond us or they're not with the organization anymore. But that is why Barrett Kent stands out to me. He's kind of one of the only players in this class who it feels like was not really of that mold. So I hope he does well. I think he was a player who I wouldn't have been surprised to see picked in the third or fourth round. Obviously a big overslot deal here. He's a physical right-hander. He's got athletic bloodlines, multi-sport background. In a solid three pitch mix, it's been 90 to 94, up to 97 at times, early in outings. Decent slider, doesn't have the best spin rates, but it's got some depth. He's shown some feel for it at times. Chance to be solid average, maybe a 55 pitch if it takes a step forward. I think just the feel of the pitch maybe will help that play up. And then he's also got a low 80s changeup with pretty good diving action. Going to need more feel for that pitch as well. But I like Barrett Kent just because you can dream on him moving forward, ticking up a little bit in the secondaries. He's shown good control, workhorse kind of frame, even though we don't see many workhorse starters overall in the big leagues anymore. But that one's fun to me just because he's so unlike most of these other picks. But yeah, it'll be interesting to look at the Angels draft like 5 years from now and see how many of these guys reach the big leagues. I think I would classify this as a safe draft, just given the profiles. I wish they would have mixed up a little more like high upside high school toolsy talent in this one, but we'll see. They're the only player, the only team with a big leaguer in this class, so they can certainly
they've got that so far.
They can beat that drum for quite a while, I would imagine.
Exactly.
All right, any last comments about the Angels before we move on to the A's?
No, I mean, I'm kind of with you. It's not really like a ton of like loud names where you, like you said, I mean, there's not really one guy I think in here that you can circle and be like, okay, he's got, you know, stupid upside and a ridiculously high ceiling. I think that they've all got, I'd say, relatively manageable, like, I don't even want to call it low ceilings, but I think you touched on it well, just rather safe picks, I guess, is the only way to categorize it.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the A's, one of the best teams in baseball at the moment. They picked number 6 overall this year, so just missing out. I mean, the A's were probably the most unlucky team in the first ever draft lottery. They were slated to pick, I think, two or three overall, dropped all the way down to number 6, which proved significant this year. I mean, some years maybe going from 2 to 6 would be more negligible, but there was definitely a big drop off in perceived talent at the draft from 5 to 6. You don't get access to that kind of elite top tier phylum of players and the A's decided to go with Jacob Wilson on a big underslot deal. Grand Canyon University shortstop. In the supplemental round, they took Miles Naylor, a third baseman out of Canada, the younger brother of Bo Naylor and Josh. In the second round, they took Rutgers outfielder Ryan Lasko. In the third round, they took Milburn High School right-handed pitcher Steven Echevarria. In the fourth round, they took Newbury Park High School right-handed pitcher Cole Miller. That's out of California. And in the fifth round, they took Texas A&M right-hander Nathan Detmer. I like a lot of the balance of this class, but I'm curious what you think of this class and what you thought of the strategy to go with Jacob Wilson with the sixth overall pick. I think if I'm remembering this correctly, Wilson was one of two players in the first round who signed for more than $1 million under slot. The other player would have been Blake Mitchell at pick number 8, two spots later. So certainly the financials come into play with Wilson here, but I don't really think it's crazy on talent either. Peter, where are you at here?
No, neither do I. And I know it was a little bit of a maybe polarizing pick, but I honestly, I mean, I was a fan. It was the performance at Grand Canyon was outstanding. Obviously with him, it's the bat to ball skills and, you know, they're elite with Wilson. I think the overall contact rate at Grand Canyon was, I might get this number wrong, but I think it was right around 95%, at least in zone.
Yeah, it's 94% overall contact rate. And then I have specifically fastballs in the zone, 97%. So you're right in that ballpark.
Right. And so, I mean, the bat to ball skills are exceptional. Obviously the biggest question with players of this profile is the impact and how much power is he going to hit for at the next level. But I think what makes Wilson appealing is the fact that he's going to stick on the left side at shortstop, where I think he's a good defender. The arm is above average, moves well, good body at 6'3", 190. The bloodlines are apparent, obviously with his dad. And then so far again, I mean, I've been really impressed and encouraged with how he's done so far, in professional baseball in high A Lansing in the Midwest League, which is a notoriously difficult league to hit in. He's hitting .318 so far, with 9 doubles, in 23 games and 1 home run. I know he's not going to be a guy that's going to put the ball over the fence really often. I think it's probably 8 to 12 plus home run upside. But I mean, for him to get the ball in the gap and down the line, it's an encouraging sign. And so far, the similar bat to ball skills are on display. 94% in zone contact rate, 96% against fastballs, really not having any trouble at all. Picking up the baseball, seeing spin. So encouraging early returns so far for Wilson, I'd say.
Yeah, and he did flash a little bit of sneaky pull side pop with Wood last summer with Team USA. I think there's some projection to the frame still. Maybe he's just always going to be one of those lean players. We have him listed at 6'3", 190. So maybe he can add some more power. I don't think you can really teach contact. So the fact that he is one of the kind of outlier players in that regard in this draft class is exciting. And I agree with you. I think he's going to be a shortstop. I think he's got all the actions and tools for the position. So even though you could maybe classify this one as like a safe pick in this range, I think the A's probably needed a safe pick in the first round. They've taken a lot of shots on high risk, high upside athletes in recent years. Not all of those have panned out. So I kind of like them going in this direction. And then they still added a little bit of upside and toolsy, risky demographics later to sort of diversify their draft portfolio this year. Saving money early on Wilson and putting it towards Steven Echevarria and Cole Miller, two really exciting high school pitchers with stuff who, I mean, Echevarria especially, I didn't expect to sign. Everything I was hearing about him leading up to the draft was, oh, he's such a tough sign out of Florida, but he really had a loud spring, transferred above average fastball. It's been up to 97, took a jump from last summer when he was touching 94. He's got a good slider. That's a high spin pitch in the 25 to 2600 range. Sharp break, chance to be above average, chance for solid control as well. He also was 17 on draft day. So just a lot of things to like with him. And then with Cole Miller, I think he's another just interesting high upside pitcher, much bigger frame than Echevarria, big and powerful, 6'5", 225 pounds, kind of like boring life to the fastball that's been up to 95. The control, I think, maybe not quite as polished as Echevarria, but I really like getting these guys in the third and fourth round range. They paid for it, obviously. It's $3 million and a million, but I kind of liked adding these two after taking a trio of more, maybe not all of them up the middle, but bats, Jacob Wilson, Miles Naylor, and Ryan Lasko. I like the balance, I would say, of their first five picks.
Yeah, and I think that going back to Wilson a little bit, you brought up a really good point. Well, I think it's a safe pick. I think that he also does have a chance to be an impactful big leaguer. I mean, I think that early on, that's the direction in which he is heading. Mm-hmm. And then you also, one thing that I really liked that you said was, you know, that you can't really teach anyone how to hit. It's almost impossible to teach someone how to hit to an extent, but you can to an extent, teach almost anyone to hit for some power, to get into some power. And I think that Wilson is a part of maybe a dying breed of players that really, really know how to hit, knowledge of the strike zone, and are super, super polished in that regard. So I might be a bigger fan than others of the Jacob Wilson pick. Mm-hmm. And then going into the third round, Echevarria might be my favorite pick in the draft outside of
big praise.
Yeah, outside of Jacob Wilson, I'm a big fan of him. He blew up obviously last summer and this spring.
So you're saying these two guys are your favorite in the whole draft or this draft class?
Oh, excuse me, the A's draft class.
I was about to say your two favorite picks in the whole draft, both A's. That's what I thought you're saying at first.
No, I worded that poorly, but in the A's draft class, one is obviously Wilson, and I think next it's Echevarria. Fastball up to 98, good carry through the strike zone, slider flash plus, throws another breaking ball and in a curveball. Also showed off a changeup. I think he moves really well. There's some projection remaining. Clean delivery with, I think, a pretty quick arm, and I think that the upside is pretty significant with someone like Echevarria, and I think that he's someone that's going to start throughout professional baseball. And honestly, in my mind, I think number two starter upside. I think he is that good a pitcher. And then going further down the board with Oakland, like you mentioned, I really like Cole Miller. He's the more prototypical, like you said, pitcher build, 6'6", 225. And then Nathan Detmer in the fifth is an interesting one. They got him for $430,000. Mm-hmm. Had, I'd say, pretty significant chatter and buzz heading into the spring. As someone who's going to lead the A&M rotation. And then again, the fastball slider combination is really, really good with Detmer. So a few interesting picks with Oakland. I like this draft class, I'd say, definitely better than LA's. I think that it's not as flashy as, you know, Seattle's or Houston's, obviously, and they don't have that, maybe that necessarily headliner like Langford. Obviously Wilson is the closest they have to it, but I think that this is it's an interesting class. And then their last pick in the draft, Diego Barrera from Loyola Marymount. He's a 6 foot lefty. He's 23. The ceiling is a fifth starter, but strike thrower, durable, kind of high mileage arm, through 99 innings at Loyola Marymount, only walked 11. Good field of pitch. Super, super polished West Coast arm. So there's really no, I think, upside there, but they got him for next to nothing. So
yeah,
they got him for 50K. So I think it's a rather solid draft class with, I think, you know, I have Wilson circled, Echevarria circled, and then obviously Naylor, the youngest of the three Naylor brothers, Miles. I think there's some exciting guys in the top five rounds.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a fun draft class. They clearly prioritized big league bloodlines. Jacob Wilson's father played in the big leagues. Jonah Cox in the sixth round, his father was a big leaguer. And then Miles Naylor, obviously both Josh and Bo were first rounders and are big leaguers at this point. So if they get three, that'll put that family in pretty rare air. So I'm intrigued with Naylor as a hitter and intrigued with his power potential as well. One name that I'll mention on day three that I was always a big fan of, just because I saw him great in person, was Luke Mann. He is exceptionally old for the class. He had been with Missouri for quite a long time. So I don't know how much tools we have here or if he's going to offer a lot of value defensively. I think he was more of like a workman-like defender at third base, but I was always impressed with his hitting ability as a left-handed hitter. He's got some power. So for $50,000, I think that's great. I thought he had a chance to get a little more than that just based on his production, but clearly the age and the fact that he was playing, basically everyone is younger than him this year. He had 311, 428, 680 with 21 home runs and a 23% strikeout rate. So I think that's a fun senior on day three to kind of cap off what really we've talked pretty positively about the A's draft class so far. So I think I'd put that right behind Seattle and Texas for me of this division. And I think you could even make a case for this one being second to Seattle, just given the fact that the Rangers had so few picks. But I just love Whiting for too much, I think.
No, it's an interesting class for sure. And I think that like maybe this class could be ahead of Texas, just like you said, with the lack of picks. I personally like Houston and Seattle's class more. But as you mentioned, like there are guys up and down this board that, you know, you're kind of like, oh, this player is interesting. This guy's interesting. Drew Conover from Rutgers started some for the Scarlet Knights, but I think he's got a chance to be a really effective reliever with a bowling ball sinker, super, super tough to pick up, slingy low three quarters, borderline sidearm slot with an effective slider. I think that's great value on day three early on with 150,000. Nate Nankle from Cal State Fullerton, super, super physical kid. I really like the body at 6'3", 190. Hit well this spring for the Macedons. I think that, again, in the seventh round for 300K, both him and Jonah Cox are exciting picks. And then Will Johnston was an effective bullpen arm for Texas A&M, and they got him in the 13th for 150. So an underrated, I'd say, draft class for Oakland.
Yeah, it's not been a lot of positives for Oakland really this entire year. So maybe if you're an A's fan, like, maybe you can feel a little better after this podcast, although I'm not really sure what happens to A's fans once they move to Vegas. But either way, they should be picking higher than six next year. We'll see if they get luckier than the first year with the draft lottery. But yeah, that's the A's and that's the American League. We are done with our draft reviews of the American League. On our next podcast episode, we will start breaking down or at least reviewing the National League draft classes. Peter, anything you want to close with? Anything that you're working on you want to let people know about or anything you want to plug, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, as usual, if you're a fan of any level of baseball, we have you covered over at Baseball America with whatever you need, whether it be on the podcast network or online. There really is something for everybody. And then personally, what I'm working on is probably going to start a freshman spotlight series. There's a good crop as always of incoming freshmen who made it to campus as opposed to signing professionally. So perhaps a weekly write-up highlighting one freshman that I'm particularly excited about. Won't be too much, around 400 words or so, but paint a picture of who that player is and the type of impact you can expect them to have for their respective college program.
Yeah, that is awesome. I'm looking forward to that series. I think it'll be fun to see what you think of them, how they're going to fit in on their college campus, because we are in that kind of part of the schedule, I guess I should say, for these college teams. Fall ball's kind of going to get started. We're going to start to get a feel for how these teams might be coming together. So it feels like college baseball is a long ways away, but it's still an important time in the calendar for them. So that'll be fun. Look out for that. And like Peter said, check out BA in general for all of our coverage on the site, on the podcast network, and really appreciate you guys sticking with us and listening to this podcast. So thank you. Thank you to the BA subscribers who allow us to do what we do. And for Peter, I'm Carlos. We'll see you next time, everybody.